in his message this time. God bless you, brother.
Well, I don't know what to make of that analogy. I guess that means that Larry and I have been leading you around in the land of Egypt, and Dr. Fuller and Dr. Ruckman will take you to the Holy Land. Yesterday, we dealt with some objections concerning Erasmus of Rotterdam, specifically that he was a coward and compromiser, that he was possibly a homosexual, that he was a Catholic, that he wasn't really scholarly, that he didn't use very good manuscripts, and the one neutral manuscript he had, he didn't refer to very much. He didn't have access to Vaticanus, and the last part of the book of the Revelation he translated directly from the Latin. So we dealt with those. We're going to deal with some more general objections to our authorized text today. And so let's just start delineating them for you now. And the first one is this: the authorized version is not from the oldest manuscripts. This is the first and most oft-reiterated objection to the AV 1611, that it was derived from manuscripts that lack the antiquity of Sinaiticus and Vaticanus. You don't have to read very far in this subject before you have that pointed out to you by any liberal book. The experts often make an assumption or two and present variant readings as coming from the oldest or the best manuscripts. You can pick up almost any reference Bible and they'll do this. You pick up a Dixon Bible and you can hardly read the thing, because right in the text they'll have in brackets, "just omit those last four words," or something to that effect. Same with Scofield, same with Thompson Chain, any one of these reference Bibles you get a hold of. In historical circles, much emphasis is placed on the primary source, as they call it. And if you go and take secular classes in history from a secular university, you don't have a very good paper unless most of the things that you're quoting in there are primary sources. All things being equal, an eyewitness or involved party is accorded the highest credibility. If there is no primary source available, the document closest to the event is generally assumed to be the best. In the case of the New Testament manuscripts, the primary sources, originals, autographs, etc., are no longer extant. So the scholars must rely on the oldest copies available, and generally, according to principles of interpretation, that oldest copy then is the highest authority. And as the scholars move back through the first and second and third centuries, they encounter a veritable blizzard of thousands of fragments and patristic quotes and literary allusions, but they do not encounter a nearly complete manuscript from the Greek until the fourth century, when Vaticanus and Sinaiticus show up. Primarily then, on the basis of the antiquity of these two manuscripts, Westcott and Hort, along with the entire revision committee of the Revised Version of 1881, make better than 500 changes and generally denigrate the value of the received text which produced the authorized version. Now, if you'll read, Westcott and Hort, they say, went cautiously at first until they got the committee going along with them, and then toward the end they made changes with reckless abandon. What is ignored by the devotees of the most ancient manuscripts' position, however, is that the argument from the weight of evidence must also be entertained before a viable conclusion is to be rendered. It would appear that the vast weight of fragments which antedate even Vaticanus support the received text. Now, we discussed last night how much of a majority that was. Depends on who you're reading. About the lowest figure that I ran into was 80% to 20% in favor of the majority, and some went all the way up to 95.5 as the breakdown for the majority text. Listen to Peter Ruckman. He says, "Now, the King James Bible is based more than 98% on this despised Syrian text. It is known from 500 A.D. on as the received text, or Textus Receptus. The discovery of papyri predating the Vatican manuscript B has proved time and time again that the Greek text of the Middle Ages in the Byzantine or Syrian type text is older than the Vaticanus, which was written in Italy in the 4th century by people who followed the mutilated manuscripts of Origen, 182 to 251 B.C., or A.D., excuse me. Philip Morrow agrees with Ruckman that the evidence for the received text is older as well as of greater volume. He states, and I quote, "Remembering that we have no actual copies, that is, original Greek texts, so old is the Syriac and Latin versions, that is, translations, by probably more than 200 years, the traditional text, Bergen and Miller, and that the oldest versions are far more ancient than the oldest Greek manuscripts, and remembering too that those venerable versions prove the existence in their day of a standard text type agreeing essentially with our Textus Receptus, and it will be recognized that the most ancient evidence is all in favor of the latter. Now that's not too clear, but what he's saying is the evidence is in favor of the traditional text. Anything, even the Bible, is the sum of its parts, and the revisionists of 1881 erred in making one or two manuscripts the judge of all the rest. And as we pointed out last night, this was all based on a genealogical descent that Westcott and Hort assumed and palmed off on that committee, and that descent has never really been put forth or is not traceable. As a matter of fact, it doesn't even exist. All of the available evidence should have been assimilated for each verse, with the antiquity of the testimony as well as the number of witnesses being considered in each case. If that had been done, sections such as the last 12 verses of Mark that both outdated and outnumbered Codex B, Vaticanus, would have been included. When other factors such as the dubious accuracy and pedigree of both Vaticanus and Sinaiticus are considered, such statements as according to the oldest manuscripts, according to the best manuscripts, a better conclusion, see the margin, etc., ad infinitum, ad nausea, are highly suspect. Now, another complaint that you will find lodged against the AV is that the traditional text is the product of editors. The textual critics believe that editors composed the traditional text about the 4th century, and they do not then represent a continuum traceable to the apostles. However, there's much evidence now to the contrary. In 1912, C.L. Freer of Detroit, Michigan, was visiting Egypt, and he purchased an early rendition of the Gospels from an Arab near what is called Giza. Scholars call Freer's document Codex W, and they say it is dated near Alf. Codex W is primarily an example of the traditional text, and to find it this early in Egypt suggests that its lineage would likely be apostolic. Another testimony to the antiquity of the traditional text is internal evidence in Codex Alexandrinus, A. This codex was given to the King of England in 1627. They'll say it's unfortunate that it showed up about 16 years too late, but it showed up in England about 1627. It was given by the Patriarch of Constantinople, and it was long believed to be the oldest extant New Testament manuscript. It resides today in a glass case in the British Museum. When we were over there a couple of years ago for the London conference, I went down and took slides of it. According to Edward Hills, in Acts and the Epistles, Codex A agrees most closely with the Alexandrian text of the B and Alf type, but in the Gospels, it agrees generally with the traditional text. Since Codex A is dated the early 5th century, those that copied it would surely have ignored spurious readings that were not 100 years old. Therefore, it could not have been the product of editors in the 4th century. It had to predate that. Another indication is the Chester Beatty discovery, which was published in 1933, and these 3rd century fragments reveal predominantly Byzantine or traditional readings. Celsus, around 180 AD, attacked Jesus Christ, and he quoted Matthew 27:34 with the word vinegar, the traditional reading, which Alf and B changed to wine. Therefore, there must have been a traditional text around, even for this fellow to get a hold of. The Peshitta version, the text of the Syrian church, is almost wholly traditional and is dated in the 2nd century. Eupholus, the missionary to the Goths, translated the New Testament into the Gothic language because they didn't have a language. He created a language, really, so they could get the gospel from what was obviously a majority or traditional text. It must be admitted that Erasmus Receptus was compiled from existing traditional texts, but he did not compile them from something that was the product of 4th century editors. Indeed, they go back all the way to apostolic times. Now, we discussed Erasmus and the problem with him yesterday, so we'll skip over to something else here. Another complaint that is lodged against the King James Bible is that the scholarship and source material of the translators in every language from the Textus Receptus itself is highly suspect. It was inferior. It's maintained by those who defend the modern versions that the King James translators did the best they could under the circumstances, but recent discoveries and the advance of education have rendered their work obsolete. It's amazing they came as close as they did. But of course, we are in so much a better position to correct them today than they were to do their original work. The Reformation era, however, produced a galaxy of thinkers that some feel is unmatched by any other era. Erasmus and Melanchthon and Luther and Calvin and Beza and Bucer and Zwingli, etc. These were all meticulous scholars who mastered the original languages, displayed depth and independence of thought, possessed adequate materials with which to work, and approached their labors with a reverential awe that is altogether lacking among the members of any committee formed thereafter. The question of relative scholarship is probably unanswerable. It's just like trying to argue today, would Muhammad Ali beat Jack Dempsey or something? It's unanswerable. You could sit around a hot stove lead for 50 years and not change opinions. But at the very least, when the translators and those people that labored in the Middle Ages are compared with those today, you must come to the agreement that they're at least on a par. They're at least in the same ballpark with each other. I believe, Brother Fuller, you're going to speak on the authorship of the King James and those people that worked on it and their scholarship, and were they able, learned men? That's right, the greatest scholars that ever lived. Now, I don't want to come on too strong like that because I don't want to be called prejudiced, but I'll let you be called prejudiced so you can do it. Perhaps of even greater importance was their spiritual approach, however. Unlike the modern committees who have featured men of questionable spiritual worth, even Hort insisted, for instance, that a fellow who didn't believe in the Trinity be allowed to work on their Bible. The King James translators all felt they were treading on holy ground. Peter Ruckman again speaks to this issue as follows, quote, "No attempt was made by the King James translators at any time to honor the man-made traditions of Rome. The apocryphal books were ignored in choosing the Greek text from the AV. No verse in the AV bolsters Roman tradition unless you twist the verse to prove it. At this time, no professing Christian preacher in a Trinitarian pulpit was publicly denying the deity of Jesus Christ. This phenomenon is not merely a common occurrence in the 20th century. It is the expected and accepted occurrence in 75% of the pulpits. Where the Catholic manuscripts, Jerome's Vulgate, revised by the Pope and taken from corrupt manuscripts agreeing with Vaticanus, play down the deity of Jesus Christ, the King James translators ignored them. I would go easy if I were you with any set of manuscripts which take this attitude towards your Savior. On the basis of scholarship and spiritual approach alone, if any revision committee in textual history was likely to be used of God in the conveyance of his absolute record, it was the Westminster, Oxford, Cambridge groupings that prayerfully endeavored to bless the English-speaking people of the world with their accurate message from God Almighty. Now, another objection is that the Elizabethan language employed by the authorized version was inaccurate and has since been outmoded. One of the utilitarian objections to the King James Version is that the Elizabethan language employed, while stately, have you ever heard that before? Flowing, poetic, spiritual, and so forth, it sacrificed accuracy and has become archaic in numerous places. According to Benjamin Wilkinson, however, not only was the English language by 1611 in a more opportune condition than it had ever been before or ever would be again, but the Hebrew and the Greek, likewise, had been brought up with the accumulated treasures of the materials to a splendid working point. The age was not distracted by the rush of mechanical and industrial achievements. Moreover, linguistic scholarship was at its peak. Many feel that the King James Bible was accurate enough at one time, but the evolution of the English language, which completely changed the meaning of many Bible words and necessitates modern versions. Ruckman calls this argument absolutely ridiculous. He says a one-page addendum would adequately explain any evolutionary nuances in the language. And he stated to me in a private interview for my doctoral dissertation the following. He said, quote, "If you follow the reasoning that they give you, you'd have to have a translation at least every 5 years." And he says, "And man, you can't even make a translation in 5 years." He says, "Isn't that a gasser? You couldn't translate them fast enough to make them relevant when they were published. They'd be outdated before they even came out." Hills discusses the problem of language in some detail in his book, The King James Version Defended. Under a heading that reads obsolete words and meanings in the King James Version, he gives this partial list. I'll just take a few of them here. Mark 6:35, by and by means at once. Acts 21:15, carriages means baggage. Mark 6:21, chief estates means chief men. Matthew 2:16, coasts means borders. Galatians 1:13, conversation, conduct. Acts 17:23, devotions means objects of worship. Acts 28:13, fetched a compass means sailed around. 2 Thessalonians 2:7, let means restrain. 1 Thessalonians 4:15, prevent actually means proceed today. Luke 14:7 through 10, room means seat or place. Matthew 10:10, script means bag. 2 Timothy 2:15, study means be diligent. Matthew 6:25, take no thought means be not anxious. Now, if you're so intellectually lazy, you can't refer to a one-page addendum, or you can't refer to something in the column, and you want the whole Bible changed because of those few little nuances that have changed, you'd be one to throw the baby out with the wash. Many labor under a misconception that the language of the King James Version is the spoken language of 1611, and such is not the case. You remember the translators were told to preserve what was best in older versions, and much, even of the style of the older versions, is preserved. We were listening to a tape by a well-known Bible teacher the other day, my brother and I, from a college in South Carolina, and he was here saying that things ought to be changed because of this, but they were purposely outmoded at the time. They wanted an enduring language. They didn't want to have something that was going to be obsolete in 5 or 10 years. Even the style was preserved. This was the only committee that was ever formed that tried not to make changes. The rest of them wanted to make all the changes they could possibly make. If you read the forewords, if you read their explanation of their work, and we were reading it last night at about 1 o'clock in the morning, Larry got a hold of one of these books that had all of the explanations of several of the versions, and anyone couldn't see the spiritual difference in that, they'd have to be blind. Every one of these forewords and the other versions were saying, this is the greatest work ever produced. We are fantastic. No other work ever has to be done on a subject once we got done. We have the greatest scholars. We've referred to the greatest works that have ever existed in the history of the world. And you read the foreword of the King James Version and it says, we are altogether unworthy. We realize that we are treading on holy ground. And the whole aura of the thing is completely different when you get to that version. Now, the fact that they purposely outmoded their work 30 or 40 years, even when it was produced, is manifestly apparent in the comparison of the preface written by the translators and the text of the version itself. In order to accurately translate an absolute history, a changeless truth, an immutable principle, an enduring language is altogether necessary. Why not a new Bible today from the Receptus? First of all, form and culture are not repeatable. They were uniquely set up to produce what God wanted them to produce in 1611, and that set of circumstances will never be repeated. We'll never have them again. First of all, and another thing is, they spoke about 94 or 5% of the language of the King James Bible was in Anglo-Saxon. You hadn't had the influx of all these foreign words that we have today. And Anglo-Saxon is simple and direct just about as much as you can possibly get it. And about 94 to 95% of the King James Version is in the Anglo-Saxon vocabulary. Today you shouldn't have another one because godly translators aren't available. Yeah, you could get, I suppose, 8 or 10 guys together that really believe something, that were scholarly enough to do it, but who would accept it? The liberals wouldn't accept it. The National Council of Churches wouldn't accept it. It wouldn't get anywhere. And then to get anywhere, you'd have to have an interfaith committee, and if you did that today, you'd have a bunch of liberals on the committee. You couldn't get a committee together today that would come up with a viable version. Today also, the English language is in a state of disrepair. Listen to T.S. Eliot. And he's speaking here of the New English Bible, and he says this: if the New English Bible were used only for private reading, it would be a symptom of the decay of the English language. The more it is used in public services, the more it becomes an active agent in that decay. And we don't even have the language, our own language, in a high enough state of repair today to do anything like the King James translators did. Dr. Ronald Horton, PhD from Bob Jones University, says, "The translators were not naive about the fact that meanings tend to change. They wanted to encase the precious scriptures in language whose meaning was already fixed and not subject to the flux of modern usage. The result of the fusing of simple Anglo-Saxon directness and literary decorum is the artistic balance that had not been achieved by earlier translation and has certainly not been attained since. It was simplicity and majesty. It is neither vulgar nor ornate." You'll never come up with that balance again, folks. And they weren't even capable of coming up with it in that day for some reason. Let's take a look at, for instance, the Douay version, which is the one that was translated closest to the King James. The Reims Douay version, 1582 New Testament and 1610 Old Testament, translated, for instance, where the King James said high priest, they said arch synagogue. They talked about such things as loaves of proposition for showbread. In Mark 8:37, the Reims Douay version says, "For what permutation shall a man give for his soul?" Now, doesn't that just reach out and grab you? In Psalm 23:5, it says, "Thou hast fatted my head with oil, and my chalice inebriating, how goodly is it?" It says, "Give us this day our supersubstantial bread." Boy, that just grips your soul, doesn't it? Would this happen in a modern translation? Well, the New English Bible, for instance, talks of feeding your pearls to pigs instead of casting your pearls before swine. No, I think we better stick with what we've got, folks. Quoting from which Bible? It says that William Lyon Phelps, professor of English literature in Yale University, said this: "Priests, atheists, skeptics, devotees, agnostics, and evangelists are generally agreed that the authorized version of the English Bible is the best example of English literature that the world has ever seen. Everyone who has a thorough knowledge of the Bible may truly be called educated, and no other learning or culture, no matter how extensive or elegant, can among Europeans and Americans form a proper substitute. Western civilization is founded upon the Bible. I thoroughly believe in a university education for both men and women, but I believe a knowledge of the Bible without a college course is more valuable than a college course without the Bible." You know why these yahoos that are coming out of our state institutions today aren't really educated? They don't know the Bible. It's been ripped out of the curriculum. C.B. McAfee, in his book, The Greatest English Classic, has said, "It is universally accepted as a literary masterpiece, as the noblest and most beautiful book in the world, which has exercised an incalculable influence upon religion, upon manners, upon literature, and upon character. Who but a fool would want to tamper with it?"
Well, it seems to me like Brother Bartlett gets a little short there. I don't mean in attitude, but in sermon. He just gets gone good and it's time to quit. And I guess that's good. There's a lot of information in a little space.